Hey, welcome to Info Under the Radar, the show where we talk with an expert to simplify everyday ideas, concepts, and subjects that surround us.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Info Under the Radar. I'm your host, Vishwajeet.
And I'm Devendra.
And today we are talking about something very interesting, something all of us have, but may not think about it on a day-to-day basis. I'm referring to personal identity. One of the reasons why we are discussing this topic is that, well, first of all, it very much interests both of us. And second of all, it gives us an opportunity to not just do our regular format where we just bring a guest, an expert of a field and dissect a topic per se. But in this episode, because this is such a personal topic that we are talking to real people, real individuals and their own stories about their identities, their formation of it all. And some of them are more relatable than the others. And one thing for sure is that all of them are very impactful and meaningful. And it's a very special episode for us, not only because it's a multi-part episode, but also because, as I already said, that it involves real individuals and their stories, and some of them are difficult to talk about and difficult to hear.
Yeah, and entirely to stretch upon the format a bit more, as mentioned earlier, the stories are interleaved into the narration at this point. So we're going to hear the stories at one point as the topic comes along and as the topic allows. And then we put forward or we bring on the table both the aspects, a regular layman's perspective from what we understand and from an expert perspective, where does that narration of the individual who shared their thoughts on that we heard in the clip comes to. So this makes the format a little bit more dynamic than what we have done in the past. And so, yeah. So as mentioned, we're talking about personal identity, which is a very broad field, but we've tried our best to cover as many aspects of it as were possible for us to bring on in as natural a way as is possible. So we'll be talking about, let's say, the aspects that you already understand, language and culture, how speaking different language makes you see the world differently or brings out a different part of your personality, then ethnical and racial aspects of one's identity. Like the various elements of identity are something that you choose. And in case of ethnicity or your racial identity, this is not what you choose, but how does it impact you? How does one relate to it? And then there are obvious ones, of course, religion being a part of it, how religious shapes one's identity. And then there are other aspects in which are slightly more difficult to talk about. In fact, religion is difficult to talk about as well if we go deeper into that. But then let's talk about sexuality or gender and how does that play. It's a very important part in formation of one's identity.
I think not only just we glanced over these identity, but rather also how one part of our identity can be so strong that it can shadow the other parts of our identity. We will hear that in, for example, how religious identities can shape someone's sexuality or gender identities as well. And on the other hand, if you don't have those, then we are also looking into, for a lot of us, especially coming from Western societies, more rather liberal mindset, where you might not have some of those strong identities. We also touched upon identities of related to your workplace, related to your career. How does identity with your faith looks like if you did not grow up with faith? Things of those natures.
Yeah. And as mentioned earlier, it's a multi-part series. In the first part, we are going to discuss language and culture and ethnicity and racial aspects of one's identity. Mm-hmm. And we were fortunate enough to be joined by an expert in the field who has been for over a decade researching on identity formation and personal identity development. We gladly welcome Professor Theo Klimstra. He comes from the field of developmental psychology and currently is a lecturer at Tufts University. Prior to that, he has been an associate professor at Tilburg University, and then in KU Leuven, he did his postdoctoral research. He has a PhD in psychology from Utrecht, and then he happens to have an extreme interest and expertise in adolescence and young adulthood identity development, personality development, narrative identity, and quantitative methods. His research primarily focuses on personality and identity formation. And that's why he was the perfect fit to talk about how an individual's narration fits into when you see it from a scholarly lens. Yeah. And then their linkages to adjustment and people, why people are who they are and how do they choose their life paths and how some of them flourish and how some of them struggle. So that is his research interest, which is very fascinating if you think about it, because all of us think about these things, but to know that someone studies that in a scholarly context and has data to study that. So we were fortunate enough to have a very like apt expert that we could have found for you.
Yeah.
So yeah, we thoroughly enjoyed that conversation and we hope that you do too. So yeah.
I think for us, it was also special that not just that we could hear stories of even some of our friends, for example, of the show, but also individuals we did not knew prior to it. And that's very special to us to just hear that. And first of all, we would like to thank all of the people who participated in it. Some of their names may be used and others might not be, because it's a very personal episode. So I hope you can also understand why some of our, in lack of better words, participants in this episode were not necessarily interested in identifying themselves.
So we tried to maintain anonymity. And again, on that note, thanking all the people who participated on topics that are slightly difficult to talk about and talking it on air that they know is going to be shared with everyone publicly.
Yeah.
Thank you once again to all of you. Without further ado, let's head on to our conversation with Professor Theo Klimstra. Hi, Theo. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for taking out time on a weekend for us. How have you been doing? How are you feeling?
I'm doing pretty well. It's the first warm day of spring over here. And next week, we'll have our spring break. So this is a good time that it's a little bit more relaxed here. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, doing pretty well here. Yeah.
Does spring breaks still excite you now that you are teaching and on teaching end? Because as a student, it does excite us. I'm not sure if it changes once one become a professor.
It's different for us. It's mostly a good time, like when we get behind on stuff to catch up with grading, preparing for the rest of the semester, that kind of thing. Especially because like 2 weeks ago, I went to a conference in the middle of my semester and. Although going to a conference is always great and inspiring, it's a terrible idea to do it in the middle of the semester in terms of keeping up with your courses. So I'm pretty happy with the break to catch up a little.
Fair enough. Okay. So the topic that we're here for today is personal identity. And then in itself, everyone understands it, but it's never enough to give enough disclaimers. So of course, we're trying to be as widespread as is possible. And we'll go into the details of what it is, what your perception of that is, or what your understanding of that is. But before we do any of that, you have been researching in the field of development, transformation, or what exactly personal identity is. What was the driving force or what was the motivation behind you starting it? Like, why did you choose this field to do your research?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so initially, at some point, of course, I was an undergrad student and a master's student in the north of the Netherlands at the University of Groningen. We had some courses on adolescent development there. And what really stood out to me is like how interesting identity development was. Mm-hmm. And I didn't perhaps entirely realize it at that point, but it might have had something to do with my own kind of positionality as well. So I'm from this part in the Netherlands that's called Friesland. We have our own little language, and so I was also raised as a bilingual in Frisian and in Dutch. As Frisians, we're very proud of our Friesianness. if I would have been in my office right now, this is my home office, but if I would have been like on campus in my office right now, you would have seen a Frisian flag behind me. A lot of people in the Netherlands make fun of us for being perhaps a little bit overly proud, but yeah, it's an important part of my identity, I think. Mm-hmm. And that's perhaps also where my broader interest in identity comes from as well. Yeah, so that's probably where it comes from. And then,
I'm just curious: made you so much connected to your Frisian identity? Was it just because it's a very tight knit circle because you guys are so small in number, or is there a deeper meaning behind it?
So we're pretty small in numbers. Yeah, there's like worldwide, there's looked it up a couple of days ago, there were something like 450,000 Frisian speaking people still, so really not that many. While I didn't really necessarily feel very Frisian when I lived there, because everybody around me was, but especially when I started moving. So at the University of Groningen, there were still a lot of Frisians, so still didn't feel that Frisian, but especially when I started doing my PhD on identity in Utrecht, in the middle part of the Netherlands, well, there weren't that many Frisians anymore. So then it really became a defining characteristic for me. And I carried that with me. And whenever I'm here in the United States, I do love to explain that I'm not like just like another person from the Netherlands, but actually from a specific part of the Netherlands. So that's
maybe for the context,
more and more important to me.
Yeah, maybe for context, can you give us like briefly what is different, let's say, for people from this region compared to for Frisians like yourself compared to rest of Netherlands?
So language wise, so the language is a little bit more towards English. So the grammatical structure, for example, even old Frisian and old English are apparently mutually intelligible. And Dutch is a little bit more towards German. So in that sense, the two languages are quite distinct. Other things that make us stand out, we're often described as stubborn, but I think that has something to do with like many other countries, Netherlands has a long history also of assimilation politics, because to build this sense of national identity, a lot of countries have had these assimilation politics. And Frisians didn't really go along with that. That's why our language is still there. So that's probably partly why we're referred to as stubborn.
Let's go back to the first aspect that sparked your interest in the field, which was language, your own language. So we have a clip from a friend of ours, which would you like to give a little background over the friend?
Sure. So without going, let's say necessarily in the details. Her name is Marie. She's from Germany. So she's half German, half Turkish, grew up entirely in Germany her whole life. And this is sort of our discussion with her about, or I should say my discussion with her about if identity sort of changes with language, meaning if we speak different language, does our identity shift or change with the use of a certain language, or how our identity might get affected with that? I think that should be good enough to start with.
Yeah, okay. So now I'm gonna play the clip.
What do you think about language as part of identity? Meaning you speak, two and a half, let's say. So you speak German, you speak English, you speak some Turkish. Do you speak any other language?
No, Latin maybe.
Latin, no. It's not English. Okay.
No, I don't speak, which is sad. Looking back, it's sad.
But let's say you speak two language more or less fluently, and then third language.
A stronger understanding for Turkish, yes.
Yeah, and so would you say that when you are speaking in German and when you're speaking in Turkish, do you think it's also a different part of you? with like as a in terms of your identity, is there like, do you feel there is some difference when you are speaking in Turkish versus when you're speaking in German, or even when you're speaking in English? I don't know. Do you feel, I'm not talking about the shyness of it, right? Like if you don't speak perfect English, for example, but what about with Turkish, for example, where, or even with English, in case you do still feel this way, that do you feel like it's also different, Marie, when she's talking in Turkish versus in German or in English?
I wouldn't say different. The only thing which I know is like, of course, German is the easiest way for me to communicate. So if it's, when it comes to something important, you want to communicate, you feel kind of, how you say, kind of restricted, because you can't really communicate or the thing you want the way you want, because maybe like in English, yeah, sometimes you don't think about the right word, for example, it's just a small thing, but in Turkish, because I don't really speak Turkish, I don't have the possibility to speak what I want to. So it's not really different, because of course, if I come somewhere and greet people in Turkish and say hello and how are you and whatever, and they, whatever, like a little bit small, daily small talk, that's not even enough. It's just some kind of phrases I can understand a little bit more, but talking really just phrases. It's not like being someone else, because I grow up listening to this language quite often, like not like every day, but really, really a lot. And it feels like home for me. When I come to Turkey and listen to the sounds of the language, or if when it comes to if they have time for praying, you hear the prayers through the whole city.
Yeah,
you know that
from mosques.
Yes, and the sounds are so familiar and so comforting, interesting. I always, when I'm in Germany and then after 2 years, maybe visit my family. And then I noticed when I was a little bit older, then I hear the sounds and it was like, and it feels like home. It's really interesting because it's like really started.
It's comforting.
Yeah. And home, like also kind of some place you belong to in a big way, not just for holiday. It's like, also, of course, I like Germany is my home, but you feel the connection even if you didn't grow up in the country.
So you think that language, even though you speak limited Turkish, but you still feel like that also is part, as a language, is part of your identity.
Yes.
Because I'm sure you will not feel that way about English.
Yeah.
Right.
But I'm sure that, for example, I was always quite bad in English in school. I was terrible. And always had a kind of struggle with the language to understand how to really speak it. Now you kind of do it, whatever.
Yeah.
But if it comes to Turkish, there's a different way of understanding. Even if I didn't learn it as a second language, if I would learn it now, it would be different than learning English, Spanish, Italian, or whatever, because you can feel it in a different way.
You can feel it. Interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I think I also don't know how sort of language defines identity. That's something maybe we can ask the guest we have for this episode. But it's very interesting what you said. That when you hear Turkey, when you are in Turkey and you hear Turkish, that it makes you feel like home. And do you feel the same about German when you are traveling abroad? And Germans are all the time kind of traveling, right? So there is a high chance to hear Turkish if you are in a hostel or in a hotel or in a beach, whatever.
The funny thing is like, maybe it's not really like the Turkish language when it comes to listening, but when you're in a country, there's some kind of sound surroundings, not like really if someone's speaking, but everything, like someone talking, maybe TV, maybe some kind of noises from the outside, everything. And they're a little bit different than here, maybe because of the animals, of the streets, whatever. And this kind of whole sound surrounding feels kind of like some deep inside you knows that this is part of you.
So from the context and now from the clip, I guess you pretty much understood what the answer. So my first basic, very basic question on that would be that, do you find some relatability here for what she said?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's always this like, if I hear Friesen, for example. Mm. So I had one Friesen speaking colleague at my previous university where I worked, like, was in the south of the Netherlands, but like one of them was Friesian speaking, and well, we were immediately friends. So because it just feels like home. It's this part of part that defines you, and it's probably the same with her, like because probably what made her more or less stand out in the environment where she grew up, at least I assume, is being Turkish, but also just her home environment was probably had this strong Turkish cultural influence. Maybe her parents were still Turkish speaking, her grandparents might have still been Turkish speaking, and then you just get this feel like, oh, that's where I'm from. This is really what defines me. So that's I can totally relate.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I can since I know her personally, so maybe I can give you a bit more context, and then I think it might be also interesting to go a little bit deeper, because if you just look at her as a you will not be able to tell that she has any Turkish parts, for example. So she did not stand out in terms of looks. Also, she grew up in this environment where her mom was speaking Turkish, not even to her directly, and it was mostly she was surrounded with German. The only time, so of course she was hearing when her mom was talking to the family and things like that, but she told me that most of the time, the only time she was hearing Turkish was a lot more when she's visiting Turkey. And that's what I wonder, like, where does this comes from, especially in her case, whereas I think for you, I guess it's a bit different. And for us, maybe hearing Hindi and then kind of having this immediate reaction. And I wonder where this might be coming from, someone who has less interaction and with the language itself, but still having such deeper connection, even though she don't even speak that language well, as she says in the beginning that she can't even communicate well in Turkish. So it's that's what I would be very curious to know, what could be this deeper reason behind it.
Oh yeah, well yeah, absolutely. So that's yes, thanks for that extra context. So if we look at identities more broadly, you could say that there's like three very broad functions, more or less, that our identities give us. Like they give us a sense of continuity, like we're still the same person that we were yesterday, and we'll next week still be mostly the same person that we are today. Coherence, so that you're going to be just kind of the same person across different contexts, or that like who you are in different contexts kind of connects to each other, those little parts. And then finally there's distinctiveness. Mm-hmm. So like, what does make you unique in a particular context? Right. And even though, like, as you said, like she doesn't really stand out as like Turkish in like, yeah, in the way she looks, in the way she talks, or in like, and even in terms of her exposure to Turkish, for example. Mm-hmm. But it might still have been like this one thing that or one of the more important things to her that like made her different from, I don't know, other people in her neighborhood, for example. Yeah, and then like add the trips to Turkey. Those might have just been very good memories as well, from childhood through adolescence and so on. And like we build our identities also based on our memories, and like she might have still had family there. I don't know. I think that's what I got from the clip as well. Well, and reconnecting with that family in a different country I would think that it does make you realize that you're a little different from the people who she grew up with as well. And all of that like might have contributed to this being a very important part of her identity. So despite the kind of lack of, or you could say lack of exposure to Turkey.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting what you said, because she actually told me that even from childhood, she did not even knew, but she always felt she has a different way of looking at things compared to her friends.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, as you said, there was some part of her which was different, of course, because she had this different parents coming from different culture, even though she grew up in this more German culture and surrounded with Germans in every shape or form. But as you said, so it was very interesting what you said, that that she still thought maybe in her head that it's very unique to her. And she told me that she definitely felt that way, that is unique about her. And she saw everything differently than rest of her friends.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's also an interesting point that you bring up there, because like, so you said that her mom was the one who spoke Turkish at home occasionally, but she might have also maybe had slightly different cultural values, even communicated the same cultural values that. That her neighbors, for example, had like in a slightly different way, because of the cultural baggage that she brought, and even that can affects the way we look at things, because we all see the world through our own unique cultural lenses, and we all describe things through our unique cultural lenses. And that's what might have happened there as well, because we also pass on those cultural values, even if we don't intend to do it.
Even if we do not take like all the juxtaposition of all the cultural values, and if you just consider language for this next doubt that I have, which is that in Marie's case as well, since she had traces of another language in her growing up years, in her early years, that made her feel like that her way of thinking was slightly different from her immediate surrounding. Could it be considered generally true in some sense that once you start speaking another language, you start seeing the world differently when you speak and think in that language?
Very direct research on that is difficult, but like indirectly you can definitely make that link, because like language is basically culture. Like we know that like the vocabulary in different languages is attuned to the social and physical context, even people in Canada and Alaska, the native people in Canada and Alaska have a lot of different words for different types of snow. If you're from a region that doesn't get a lot of snow, it's just snow. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah.
So like there you can even see that like the physical context determines what our language is like. On top of that, the social context determines shaped our language. And through that, through our language, we try to either like we try to communicate cultural values, or we just happen to communicate cultural values without intending to do so. So in that sense, you can definitely indirectly make that link that you suggested.
Yeah, I guess language, along with the experiences which speaking a certain language bring to us, may, or memories, as Theo said, led us building some parts of our identity, I guess. I think something you mentioned earlier was that language sort of can even lead to the, what did you said about the physical space itself?
So what language partly represents is also like, if a language is the common language in a particular culture, then the vocabulary, the whole composition of the language is all also shifted to accurately or conveniently communicate about that particular context including physical components of that context, like, well, like the snow example that I gave.
Yeah, I think the physical space kind of reminds me of the next story which we have in space.
Yeah. So since we are on the topic of culture and language now, another part of culture, of course, being race. And it's a difficult topic to talk about. So for that, we're thankful enough to a friend of mine. He's black/mixed person who lives in the States at the point, has grown up in a very heterogeneous environment. And at one point, I talked with him about, is there an incident in his life which made him realize his racial identity? And I'll share the audio now to see what his answer was. Has there ever been an incident where you felt you made to realize about the color of your skin more?
Like where I wasn't super conscious of skin tone and became more conscious of it?
Kind of like that, where you felt like you were just treated differently because of the colors.
Yeah, very frequently, for sure.
Do you remember any major ones that impacted you deeply?
Impacted me deeply? Let me think. I want to give like a good one. I think part of the problem with like it for me for answering this question is like there's so many past like I don't even want to say like microaggressions that run through your mind when you're asked this, and some things that are more serious where it's like it's hard to like pick out like a formative moment. I would say like the first, this is more like a collection of experiences. I decided when I was 17, I decided to grow my hair out into a big afro. And that was like, you know, that was some time ago and it was less common than it even is today. And so I was getting, the amount of attention I got from it wasn't something I had even thought about as like a possibility.
Okay.
That it would garner a lot of attention and comments. And it became something where I was constantly getting attention because of the afro from white people and unwelcome physical touches from them. Like they felt like they had access to my body without my permission on a consistent basis. Where like they would always touch my hair most of the time without asking. And it became like some people would get aggressive with you and you denied them access to you. It's just like it happened a lot. And it shook me a bit. It was something I wasn't ready for and that I hadn't talked about with anyone prior to experiencing it.
Oh, okay. I can imagine that would be, yeah. What was your response to that? Like once you noticed it?
Initially it was, I was like a sort of, at first it was a little deer in the headlights because I was like, you know, you're kind of like trying to assess the situation before you react to it. You don't want to be like angry black guy. So I'd say the first time I was like a little more reserved and I was just like, I would like, you know, sort of like shirk away and try to like flee the situation. And then after a little bit, I would be like, you know, like be like, hey, that's not okay. And try to approach it with like more of like a, I'm assuming you know that don't know that this isn't okay, and try to tell them why.
Did it change something in you?
Yeah, I would say that it changed how I viewed my existence in space and relative to like it. So like not like physically, but like in terms of like. I viewed how it changed how I viewed other people viewed me. And like, so essentially that there were a lot of people who kind of assume like they have some sort of privilege to do to you things regardless of how you feel about it. So like almost like an immediate, you're immediately objectified before any other interaction. And then, you know, there's like, the problem is like not acting like as if that's always the case. You know, you can't operate in the world and interact with people like mm-hmm. that is how they're automatically going to treat you. And I think like, I've seen it with other people where they have like, you kind of have some trauma responses where you kind of are excessively rude to people who treat you like that right away. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's very understandable, but, and it's hard not to do that sometimes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Raw thoughts on the clip first. A slightly difficult conversation, I assume.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've been actually talking about, so I've been to a conference here where it's a Society for Research on Adolescence. It's a lot about, identity related topics. So speaking from that, like one of the great things there, like that was that we for the first time had like what felt like a more equal representation of like Black folks, Asian folks, and it was mostly people from the US. So and actually one of the speakers we then a week later also invited to Tufts to talk studies identity in Black men but Black women or Black girls. And what stood out to her as well is that she didn't even ask for any particular, she just had interviews more generally about identity, but 93% of her participants mentioned their hair. So in that sense, that immediately stood out to me in this clip as well, that like for him, it was like, an important, like he didn't even think necessarily about it, but it became kind of probably an important part of his identity as well. Other things that obviously stand out to it stand out here is just the racism that is involved. Like, just personally, I just don't understand how as a white person you can feel like it's okay to just randomly touch somebody's hair. Like, has never happened to me. It will probably never will happen to me. It's just kind of it's just kind of crazy. And I read a lot about this, like this is not unique. It happens a lot to Black mm-hmm. people. The kind of message that you implicitly or even explicitly communicate there is that it's okay for you as a it's just marginalization, like that, like mm-hmm. there's differences between people, and some people have the privilege to do some things and other people, whereas other people don't have privilege to do that back, basically, because I could imagine if he would have done it back, also touched their hair, like I would not know what would have happened. I my guess would be that there would be an aggressive reaction right away, whereas the people who did the touching would probably assume that it would be okay to touch that your friend's hair. So that there's this like power imbalance that has to do with basically like the way our societies are structured. So structural racism is basically what I hear in this clip. And of course, that can become that factors into your racial identity as well. So that's
I'm actually curious. So just to understand, I mean, so you cannot see because of my head, but I have really long hair at this point. I'm growing it for like 4+ years. So there, and I'm someone whose hair get touched quite often, to be honest, like especially in social setting. And I was, when I heard the story, so first of all, first time I was sad to hear the what he has to go through, but on the other side, I wanted to understand, like, is it actually like something structural, or is it just more like people thinking, okay, it just looked different, different means unique, and then it's just a natural human reaction to do that. And I'm just trying to understand that, because I'm trying, because maybe the person who, and I'm not trying to empathize with someone who did that to this person who had to, who got shook literally, as he said himself, but I'm still trying to understand, is it, do you think that comes from a certain privilege? Is that what you're trying to say, that, oh, I am just allowed to do that? Because their reaction might be, yeah, you can touch my hair, because you said maybe there would be aggression, but maybe there won't, right? Maybe it's just a matter of, oh, you have different looking hair, which is true if it's an afro. And I guess for a lot, I don't know, but maybe a lot of white people don't see that much afros. I mean, especially in places like Europe, let's say, you definitely don't see that. Of course, this is more of incidents from US. So I wonder, is it actually, can we say that it's sort of, and it's, I know, and I understand that it's kind of slightly going away from the identity topic, but I do want to understand from a psychological perspective, can we say, is it just more the curiosity of it all, where, oh, it looks different, so it's exotic, in lack of better words, or is it something actually what you think is more structural, let's say the power imbalance, as you said?
I know that, like, here in the US at least, typically it is described as like, yeah, related to structural racism. Yeah, that doesn't, like, so the problem with structural racism is that, like, perpetrators who go along with it do not necessarily have the intention to participate in racism at a more individual level. It can just partly be because, like, it seems acceptable to do that. So in this context, I would describe it as such. The problem is also with racism. The thing is also, like, if the person who the victim in this case, feels like it's racism, then it's kind of is racism. So that's kind of the complexity as well. The other thing is, it also depends on who touches your hair, basically. If it just happens regularly, and it's people you don't really know yet. I don't know, maybe that's the case for you as well, but that's of course different than, like, being in a bar with friends and you've got, like, long hair, so your friends want to touch it.
Another thing that I wanted to ask about this in context of this story was, as you mentioned, that it's racism in this case could be construed as something structural in nature. And taking the argument into account, let's assume for the sake of the discussion that if the person with the afro hair would have touched back the hairs of the white person in this case, there would have been some sort of aggression, verbal or physical, we don't know yet. Now, my idea is that if you take 17, 18 year old people, they are almost mature enough to entertain the thought that if I do one thing to one person, I'm allowing the other person to do that to me, because the reciprocation is the easiest thing to understand. But in this case, the reciprocation is somehow in their brain engraved to be the fact that, okay, that should be reason enough for me to escalate it in some sort of a violence or aggressive manner. Now this, as we talked earlier, identity is about ideals. Now this is one of the ideals that the white person in this example is carrying. But if we assume that what your proposition given is right, that it's societal or structural in nature, that means there is a heavy influence that is making the person feel entitled enough about his or her ideals that a reciprocation is not something that is to be tolerated. Now, the question then becomes is, at which point does this understanding or how does this understanding propagate that, okay, this ideal that I have is an influence, and this ideal that I have is something that I believe in. Is there a structure to it? How does it propagate? How does it manifest?
Yeah, that's also a complicated question, which basically, that's the complexity involved in structural inequalities more generally. So we are, eventually, we all are the system, right? Like, Without us, there would not be any system. However, like at a larger group level, there are these ideals, there are these messages, there are these what we call master narratives, like shared ideas about like what is okay, what is not okay, what it means to be a good, quote unquote, good person in a certain society. A lot of different things feed into that. So different opinions of people feed into that. And you can either go along or you can resist to those, master narratives. And if enough people resist those master narratives, then they can change. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what could happen or should happen as well with, of course, systemic inequality. So
sort of taking back our conversation around identity again, as someone myself who I don't think I have sense of strong racial identity per se, I guess mostly because I grew up in a very homogeneous society. Maybe that's the reason. But I wonder what leads to a strong racial identity in people? Is it mostly of course you can say it's probably a mixture of both positive and negative experience associated to it, but do you think for marginalized community, in this case we heard a story of a mixed race person, is it mostly comes from the negative experiences, like he had such a young age at 17, you got really shook that someone is touching your physical space, and then maybe that can lead to him feeling a certain way about being Black? Does it come mostly from the negative experiences, or it's very like individualistic based on our experiences? It could be a combination of positive or negative.
It can relate to both, of course. Like probably at a more explicit level, like what we explicitly remember might be slightly more likely to be the negative things. But yeah, like positive things, like white people in this country or like other like very segregated countries, because for example, well, one example would be South Africa, to just name one. We also you constantly get these messages basically that you can, as a white person, you can, well, I wouldn't say do whatever you want, because that's not true necessarily, but like that you've got a different position perhaps in society. Although like in South Africa, this has changed. In the US, it's slowly changing in some areas, and it's also more complicated than just than privilege just being associated with race, because people from more in the middle parts of the country, like rural parts there, are basically also marginalized, portrayed as backwards, which is ridiculous, but that is what the messages that are spread around. So you could say it's easier to see how the negative things, if you have these negative experiences, it's easier to remember them. Whereas with the positive experiences, it just feels more like a given, and you don't necessarily remember them. You just think that it's the way it is. Yeah. That's probably mostly how it works. That's my the best question that I can provide to that answer. To go back a little bit to the hair incident or incidents. Part of what is also important to consider there is how touching other people, how that is perceived within a particular cultural context. So for example, in the Netherlands, and I assume, or at least I partly know that it is to a certain degree true in Germany as well, there is like less awareness of other people's personal space. And for example, in the grocery store in the Netherlands, people would always get very, very close to me. Also when the first couple of months of COVID, when I was still there. Dutch people are not very good at social distancing at a group level. Some people in the Netherlands are, but like as a group, not that great. Whereas here in the US, like there's more like respect for personal space. People don't get as close to you in the grocery store. If you walk on the sidewalk, people don't keep on walking straight into you and then at the very last moment try to weave around you. People, more quickly leave some space for others. So that probably also makes these kind of that makes it even stand out more if somebody enters your personal space, whereas like in different contexts that might be different.
But there's also cultural aspect to it. I remember when I started learning German, then there was this intercultural workshop. So there were people from all over the world. And we were doing a very basic exercise, which is you would have like one guy and one girl standing in front of each other, like 2 meters apart. And it's before COVID. So 1.5 meter is no special distance at this point. All right. So we are standing roughly 2 meters apart. And then one of the person has to start walking towards the next person. And the other person has to say, stop. The point they start feeling uncomfortable. And everyone did that. And at the end, you could see that. And then everyone at the end stopped it and they remained at that place. And then you could turn around and see in the entire room that the distance in every other country's perspective was so dramatically different. And then you see that, okay, that becomes a part of their comfort level. That becomes a part of that. In some cases, it was almost like it's if they take one more step, it would be toe to toe. And in other cases, if I stretch out my hand entirely, I would still not be able to touch the person. And I have a really long hand. So that leaves with that. There's another clip from same person I took the interview of. And before I play that, this was the clip where I realized my fallacy, like the flaw in my understanding. My understanding was that racial identity is not something that children understand. I thought it's only for adolescents or adults. But now let's hear to the clip where how I was being contradicted.
I know here, I think it's different. So like, I feel like maybe it's different because you grew up in a much more homogenous culture, I feel like.
Yeah.
So I think with like, I did volunteer at like a daycare for a while. And I definitely noticed it at a younger age because we had I grew up in East Boston, which is like a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood. And I'm of mixed descent. So there were white kids, Black, Hispanic kids, and then, well, you know, me. So I noticed it at a very early age because, you know, kids are very curious and they're like, oh, so like, what's your background? You know, they ask that. And, you know, you say, oh, well, I'm Black. And then some of the other Black kids will be like, oh, well, you don't look Black to me because, you know, I was even much more light skinned even at the time. And so, you know, you get like, you know, the Black kids will be like, oh, you don't really look Black. Like, what's your, you know, they ask more questions. And then the white kids will be like, oh, well, you can't be white. And so it's like from a very young age, you get exposed to that kind of stuff. But yeah, at the daycare, it was mostly almost all white children, except for one little girl. And I remember she came up to me and she said, you're the only not white person here. She had to be like 4.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And so I at first didn't know how to react to it because she wasn't white. And so I took a second. I was like, I decided to tell her. So I took a second. I was like, I'm not actually. And she was like, yes, you are. What do you mean? She started looking around and I was like, you're not white either. And it dawned on me, she was probably adopted and that she probably had white parents. And that's why she didn't realize that she wasn't white.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and she was like, what? And I was like, and it was like, yeah. And then it was time for pickup and she had to go. So we didn't really get to have a deeper conversation on it. But it was really interesting that like she thought she was white to me, like at 4. And she knew the distinction as well based on skin color. So it was, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's yeah. That was that's an interesting yeah. Basically, situation that is described there. Of course, parents do, for example, talk perhaps about racial groups and so on. So in that sense, this girl could have picked up on that. And maybe what is not uncommon in childhood is that you completely define yourself by your parents, basically. so that might have been why she thought she was white, because that's more or less like a normal thing in childhood. Like, we call it childhood identifications. Like, one example would be, once was again at a conference with a former colleague. She had brought her probably by then like 5 or 6 year old kid, and we as you do at conferences, you sometimes go for a little local tour. Wasn't Lithuania, I think. So they have these very old Eastern Orthodox churches there. So we went in there, and like, it's beautiful. And but the kid said, okay, so we're in the church, but we don't really believe in God, right, Mom? So basically, kid didn't really have like his own idea yet about like religion, just like believed whatever his mom believed, basically. So that would be a childhood identification. And in childhood, that's kind of normal. And then like at some point you start questioning those kind of identifications. And start thinking about like what it means to be a member of a certain group. So it could be related to religion, could be related to gender, could be related to identity, to race. And then it becomes more of an identity, because then you really identify with it, personally identify with it. And that's this girl might not have been at that point yet, but children do already think in groups. And with gender identity, for example, they do already have from pretty early on like ideas of what it's what it's like to be a boy and a girl, partly because we set up the entire environment to kind of perpetuate those ideas by the toys that they're given, by the messages they receive, by
the color of their clothes sometimes.
Absolutely, also like what they're disciplined for, like. Mm-hmm. As a boy, you might be able to get away with more fighting than as a girl, for example. Mm-hmm. So that's just speaking of the gender binary. So that's mm-hmm. That's the other thing. We also teach the gender binary from pretty early on, unintentional often, but sometimes also more intentional. So that's
from a developmental psychological perspective, as you mentioned that you study that, if in an ideal isolated case, if it were possible to raise children in a gender, race, and religious / spirituality agnostic way, that mm-hmm. all these factors are not taken into account, if there is a box out there in which this could be done, would that even lead to something more of a more nicer, better results as we have as of now? Or would it create more, I don't know, chaos than what already is happening?
That's a very good question. It would be an interesting experiment, I would say. from a researcher perspective, I would say you would never get that through an ethical review board, but it's interesting to think about. I think part of the problem there is I would think that people would just find different things to, sort of distinguish themselves with. I don't know. It could be something weird like food preferences or eye color or whatever. We seem to have this sort of idea of categorization. But the values that we attach to this categorization, of course, that is something that we can definitely do something about. So, and I personally, I think that that's what we should aim for. To reduce systemic inequality rather than like,
isolating it. Interesting that, like, given nonetheless any option, we would try to identify with some sort of categorization. And so far, the obvious ones have become structural in nature. That's a very fascinating thing to know.
Thanks. Yeah. To give just one a random example based on a cartoon. South Park, for example, played around with that idea, where they have otters in the future making fun of each other from eating from their belly or not. So I think it's a broader idea of like if we don't categorize on one thing or like determine group membership on one thing, we might still do it on some very silly other thing. So yeah.
I just wanted to quickly go back to what you said. So you said something interesting that as children, we tend to identify with certain things which our parents tend to identify. Case in point, religion, with the previous example of Orthodox Church. And then at a certain point, we started questioning that. And then once we accept that, then it becomes our identity, right? That's what you said. And yeah. I'm curious, that does not happen for a lot of people, or at least it does not visibly happen, I think, particularly in more traditional societies. Of course, I'm putting a very big blanket here, so apologies for that. But just for the sake of argument, like in more traditional societies, it does not tend to happen. This questioning never necessarily takes place. Then would you still call someone's identity? So for instance, if someone grew up, I don't know, Hindu or Muslim or Christian, because their parents were. And then now, since the childhood, they always associated themselves because of their parents. And then now they are an adult, and they still associate themselves to this particular religion or faith, whatever you want to call it. Would you still call it someone's identity in this case? Because they may not have choosing it, it's more the society or the parents and everyone chose it for themselves.
That's a great question. The thing that I should emphasize is that even though like you might not change your religion through this process from going to an identification to an identity, you might still start thinking a little bit different about like what it means to be part of a church. However, there are of course differences, cultural differences in the pressure that is the pressure that you might feel at least to remain a member of that like religious group, for example. Still, I would say that At least at some point, there might at least be some like questioning of how do I exactly see my faith? What does it really mean for me? And as soon as that happens, then it becomes an identity. However, it might not yet might be just be less visible like that that process because of the societal pressures or because it works. If it works for you, why go for something different, right? So that's that's also part of the deal.
Makes sense. So with that, we have come to the end of part one of our discussion on personal identity. Thank you, Theo, for being with us for this while, and we'll talk to you soon in the part two. For all our listeners out there, please stay tuned for the next part where we talk about other aspects of personal identity and new guests, new clips, and more insights into it. Stay tuned.
Hey guys, if you have reached this point in the episode, then thanks a lot for listening to the entire episode. We really hope that you find the episode informational as much as we did. Before you leave, just one small request. If you want to keep track of what we are releasing every week or want to know more about the additional content which we produce regularly, please follow us on our social media. Our Instagram is info under the radar. On Twitter, we are at @info_under_radar. We are also active on LinkedIn. That's also info under the radar. That's it for now. Bye.